Have you ever found yourself in the middle of an international incident at the height of the Cold War? Well, my guest today almost did.
This is the Greatest Story Ever podcast.
There comes a time when all the cosmic tumblers have clicked into place and the universe opens itself up for a few seconds to show you what's possible.
With Keith Conrad.
You know, everything is not an anecdote. You have to discriminate. Here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
Two people have a great story to tell are Doug and Kim White of Lombard, Illinois, not too far from me. The couple said they missed the experience of eating out when the coronavirus led to dining rooms being closed. Getting takeout just didn't offer the same experience for them. So in October, they converted the back of their transit van into a miniature dining room. Doug said the dining room cost about $100 to put together, so not bad at all. The couple has since been visiting all of their favorite restaurants in the area and having plated food delivered to them in the back of the van. See, this is what we do in America. We adapt and overcome. Of course, you'd already be aware of Kim and Doug White if you had gone to KeithConradMedia.com and signed up for my free email newsletter, The News Side Quest. Every weekday, you'll get a handful of entertaining stories just like that one. You might call them the greatest stories ever emailed. I wouldn't, but you could. Also, please rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to be listening to help more people find my plucky little podcast. My guest today is the co-host of the Minutia Men podcast on the Radio Misfits podcast network. He's the author of several books, including Severance and Every Cub Ever, which is a book that absolutely delivers what it promises. Plus, he's a publisher at Eckhart's Press, where, by the way, you can also find my debut novel, Righteous Might. Rick Kempfer, thanks so much for joining me.
Happy to do it.
Now, not to give my age away too much, but, you know, I think I was in third grade when the wall came down in Berlin. And so, like, I don't have exactly the same memories of the Cold War that a lot of other people do. But you know, still, like, I realized, even though I was a youngin, I realized that was a significant event. But you were actually there when the wall came down.
I was. I went to get pieces of the wall because I had a history with Berlin. It was a really important city in my life, and you know that's one of the reasons I'm on with you is to tell you the story of what happened there. But at the time the wall came down, it was the biggest story in my lifetime. It was just gigantic. I mean, it was like winning the Cold War. That was the symbolism of what that meant at that time.
Yeah, and I think even though I was really young at the time, I knew it was really significant. You know, even I wouldn't say it was the biggest story going on because I think it was roughly at about the same time as the first Gulf War. So I think like that for some reason that one hit me personally a little bit. A little bit more. Like I was so young when that happened that I was actually worried about, like, you know, the Iraqi military coming to Alabama and like invading our yard.
Yeah, I can see that. Plus it was on TV. It was, you know, a war on TV.
It was. Yeah. So did you actually see David Hasselhoff like when the wall was coming down?
I did not. But, you know, as I'm a German, so, you know, my family, we're immigrants, first generation, came here in the 1950s. I'm born in 63 in Chicago, but my parents were both German immigrants, and they had just been here briefly, you know, I think 5-6 years before I was born. So I grew up in a house where we didn't even speak English. And then when I was about 10 years old, we moved back to Germany. My father was then working for the Department of Defense. So living in Germany during the Cold War, it was a very scary time. I mean, there were roaming bands of assassins and terrorists killing Americans. There was a bomb placed in the building that my father had lunch in every day. And for one reason or another, he couldn't make it that day. And the bomb blew up many of his colleagues. That's how real the Cold War was to us. I mean, it was, there were bomb threats all the time at my junior high school, my high school. We were scared. And when you went to Berlin in those days, Berlin was broken up into four parts, as probably most people know. And mm-hmm. you had to drive through East Germany to get to West Berlin because it was in the middle of the country. And you didn't drive there. You took the train. That was the only way to really get there. And on the train, they would stop, and you often had to stop in the middle of the night, and the Russian soldiers would come on to your train, and they would search all of your belongings, in the train car. So on the way there, you knew you were going to somewhere that was, exotic, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. So Berlin, that was part of West Germany, even though it was in East Germany, or was it like a Singapore sort of thing where it was all on its own?
Right. No, it was part of West Germany. But the capital was not in Berlin at that time. The capital was in Bonn. Mm-hmm. That was the West German capital. And
I think it just would have been awkward to have like all the members of the German legislature like searched every time they had to go into the capital.
It was weird. You know, it's almost impossible to describe how strange it was. I was telling you before we started taping that the streetcar lines in West Berlin were, you know, it was top of the line. Everything was rebuilt after the war. It was beautiful, mm-hmm. but the wall didn't go up immediately. So you could see where the streetcar lines went into East Germany by the fact that they were abandoned. Weeds were coming through. Nobody used that part. It was like this train to nowhere.
Yeah, and my only experience with that is literally seeing the Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg movie Bridge of Spies.
And, right.
I'm not sure how much it changed between the early 1960s and when you were there, but it wasn't a pretty picture then.
No, I my first time seeing Berlin, West Berlin, was with the Boy Scouts on a camping trip. We went there to West Berlin, and we camped near the wall. So that's when I started hearing the stories of, the snipers and the landmines, and you go to Checkpoint Charlie and you see, there was a history of everybody who had tried to escape, underneath the cars and, tied, on roofs of cars and digging tunnels and everything. And it really was a scary place. But when you walked along the wall, and this is what happened on the day that this story takes place, you walk along the wall, you could see the soldiers marching back and forth, manning the wall on the other side, mm-hmm. Looking for people that were going to try to climb the wall. And they would shoot people dead trying to escape. Even after you made it over the wall, there was a little a river there. If you did not make it across that river, they could shoot you in the river.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that you were... They felt comfortable having you camp on the West German side,
right?
Of the wall, because yes. Not many people were trying to escape from the West German side into the East German side,
right? It was like a history lesson for us, just to see what was going on there. But even on the West side, you could it was scary. I was like 12 years old. It was scary for a 12-year-old for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, when the wall came down, I think it was in third grade, and I remember very clearly my third grade teacher. I won't mention her name just because I don't want to incriminate her in anything.
Yeah.
But this was obviously the biggest story anybody was talking about in the world, at that particular moment. And she informed our class that, they were reuniting Germany. And this was something to be scared of, because the whole reason Germany was split up was because every time the Germans get together, something bad happens. And that was why we decided to keep them separately. And Obviously, years later, I learned that was not true.
No.
Actually, probably months later, I learned that was not true.
Yeah, no, that was not true.
Yeah. So your story is basically your run-in with the East German secret police.
That's what it is. Yes. So, yeah. All right. So now that you have the background of my family, my father was an employee for the Department of Defense. He worked with the Army Corps of Engineers, but he also would translate for the generals. And one of the generals he translated for was Al Haig.
Oh, wow.
You know, he'd go to Army headquarters. He'd go to, NATO headquarters. And he dealt with the generals a lot. We had several different kinds of identification. One was just the normal U.S. passport and a U.S. Identity card. And then there was our diplomatic passport. And then there was the one that said that my dad worked for the Department of Defense. And my dad said to me before we went to visit my uncle who lived in East Berlin, he said to me, whatever you do, don't bring that one. Don't bring that one because we have to go through, you know, the Checkpoint Charlie and everything. And I thought, you know, even though I was scared of what was going on there, I thought they're not going to search a 12-year-old kid. I really didn't think it was that important, which is unbelievably stupid in retrospect. I have no idea what I was thinking.
Well, not for a 12, 13-year-old.
Yeah.
That seems about right.
Yeah. So we go through the checkpoint, Checkpoint Charlie. And, you know, as we're in line, I see these, the German secret police, the East German secret police, and they looked scary. You know, they weren't quite wearing monocles, but
monocles, those hats with the big spike on the top.
Right. They weren't wearing those, but they looked like Nazis to me. You know, they looked very scary. And
I think the budget in East Germany was so small that they were actually just reusing the Nazi uniforms.
Probably. But, you know, they were searching very thoroughly. And sure enough, they did search 12 and 13 year old kids. And sure enough, they found my ID card that said my father worked for the Department of Defense. And so they separated us and questioned my father. I'd say interrogate, but it was really more questioning him about who he was and where he was and what he did. And because I was separated off by myself, I was, of course, crying like a baby. I'm like a big planning the rest of my life in an East German prison. But I don't know how long we were separated. And they finally came out and got my father said, all right, they're going to let us go. But what they did was they followed us with the secret police followed us wherever we went. And so did the Russian soldiers. And we had lunch with my mom's uncle at a restaurant in East Berlin. And my uncle was a professor at the university. And he said, you realize this is going to, I'm marked now as someone that they're going to keep an eye on. You realize that, right? And all of the people, like the waiter would come over and take our order, and he and my uncle would make us shut up when he came over there, and he'd say, that guy's a spy. That guy over there, the bartender, he's a spy. You know, everybody here, they all tell on each other. Everything is, you cannot trust anyone. And we'd walk out onto the streets, and Russian soldiers were following us wherever we went. It was scary.
Was this the first time you had met this relative? So that's literally like his introduction to you.
Yep. First time I met him. And the last time. I've never seen him since. He's passed away since. He did live long enough to see the wall come down. Cause that was, I think 15 years later or something like that. It was the scariest day of my life.
It sounds like it would be up there. Like, the You know, I'm sure you have plenty of chapters left to write, but I would imagine that it'll be up there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully my remaining chapters do not involve the East German secret police.
I wouldn't.
No. You know, it's I don't think I'm even explaining how scary it was, because these guys could have put us in prison and there was nothing that we could have done. You know, we had no defense. That once we got into East Germany, we had no protections of any kind. And they knew that my father worked for the U.S. government. You know, if somebody wanted to go rogue and throw us in jail or whatever, in retrospect, it's even scarier. And, you know, my father, to his credit, never yelled at me about it. But later on, like 10 years later, he explained the situation to me, that part where I hadn't realized how much danger we were in. Mm-hmm. And what kind of danger we put my mother's uncle in. Luckily, they didn't imprison him or anything, but that was... We brought a bunch of contraband in with us, too.
Yeah, of course you did. Yeah. And I could just see, you know, your mother's uncle being like, you know, because I remember a couple of years ago, I met some very distant relatives who actually, you know, lived in Canada. And, you know, they're like, you know, fourth cousins or something like that. Uh-huh. And, you know, so we've literally met them once and spoken to them once, and that's it. And so, like, I just imagine him being in that exact same situation. And I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just had to meet my American relatives.
Right. Exactly. You know, it was his favorite sister, his little sister's daughter, you know, so he really wanted to meet my mom. But we certainly came with a lot of baggage.
And the baggage was filled with contraband.
It was. We brought cigarettes and we brought Levi jeans, but we couldn't give it to them because they were watching us the whole time.
Well, at least at this point, you could if you went back there.
That's right. That's right. And now my doctor just came back from East Berlin. And he told me that the art world there is really thriving, that, you know, it's like a, you know, going into like Bucktown or something in Chicago. Like the artsiest neighborhoods are in the old East Berlin.
That kind of makes sense, because it would be the sort of like untilled ground to move in and
right.
Rebuild.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's probably last week's guest almost drowned, but I think you may have the scariest story. So thanks so much for sharing your story, Rick.
Happy to do it. Thanks for writing a great book called Righteous Might, available now on Eckhart's Press.
If you think you can top Rick's story, well, first of all, if you can, you're probably Gary Francis Powers or served on the U.S. Pueblo or something. But if you think you can, shoot me an email at greateststoryeverpodcast@gmail.com.
Gabatron?